I'm glad you guys invited me here because you're slumming it down with like the e-com millionaires again.
This is like a Make-A-Wish type of episode for us. You know?
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel. Never.
There's really two things that I need to talk to you about. There's two reasons you're here. Number one, I cannot believe that you sell hundreds of millions of dollars of this stupid little wallet. This is unbelievable to me. It's been blowing my mind ever since I found that out. And now you're here finally to give us some answers. And two, I think you're very opinionated when it comes to e-com. You don't hold back. You don't pull punches. And so we like that. We like spicy guests. And I think you're going to be able to have both of those things for us.
I think you should smack Sean right now for calling his stupid little wallet. Did you hear that?
Stupid little wallet. I'm just trying to get him fired up. I told you he gets fiery. He gets feisty. So I wanted to, you know, stir the pot a little bit.
You better play nice. I'll dox your e-commerce brand.
That's true. He's got some.
He knows too much.
He's got some compromise on me.
Dude, I've been a Ridge wallet owner since 2016 or 17. You know, Ridge sponsored the Hustle.
Well, dude, thank you for the support. And you guys were super early for newsletter sponsorships. Like, we probably run like a pretty big sponsorship like ecosystem now. We sponsor like a ton of newsletters, like, you know, YouTubers, obviously. You guys were like one of the first people selling that ad space. So,
yeah. And you know what I learned about your guys' industry? Well, just any marketer who's savvy is people like you and Sean. You guys know how to find early interesting stuff and you take all of the risks. And you understand the arbitrage, like the underpriced opportunity. And so we had a lot of smart people who would buy these ads with us. And I'm like, I can't believe they're doing this. This is so unproven. And then I realized that that's like the theme of a smart marketer, which is throw dollars at a variety of things and then exhaust it once everyone else comes and finds it.
Yeah, it's ad arbitrage, right? Like everything's attention. So if I'm giving Facebook at this point $15 per 1,000 views, and if I can get a better price off of newsletters or influencer or YouTube, like, it's all just an attention economy. And it's so funny to watch that like pendulum swing back. Linear TV, like the TV your parents probably watch, is so cheap to run ads on because nobody's buying it. So like, you know, I'll probably spend,
what's like the CPM of linear TV?
$1. Like,
oh wow.
It's like, because there's all these channels, right? There's been like, you know, thousands of channels that have come out that like have 800 people who watch them. So like you just buy like big blocks of random ad space that are just very mail targeted. And like, yeah, literally like $1 to reach 1,000 people.
Sam, do you know what our best performing ad channel is, our marketing channel for my brand? Postcards. What? But you would not believe it. Postcards. It's not super scalable. Like you can't just like spend to infinity on it. But you know, you put $1 in, you'll get $8 or $9 out of revenue. It's amazing.
That's great. You use Postpilot.
Postpilot. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So okay. So Sean, we should start at the start. So what's cool about y'all's story is you sell a simple product. It wasn't like some Mark Zuckerberg, you know, innovation or anything like that. And you've scaled it up. You've built it brick by brick. But you said you started in like a sort of a sweaty services business. You didn't start the company and you didn't start off in the product game. So can we just do your story for a little bit? And then I want to brainstorm other D2C ideas with you afterwards. But first, let's do your story.
Sure. Yeah, you got that right. The show's my first million. So I made my first $1 million off of an ad agency. So, you know, Facebook ads came out in 2012. That was like when it was probably like an open beta. Anybody could join. And I learned how to do Facebook ads. I worked at an agency with my CMO, Connor, and the agency sucked. Like, you know, it was 200 people working there, probably 500 clients.
Nobody, you were an employee?
Yeah. I was just an employee. And then I was like, oh, I should do this. I could do a better job of this. The ad agency I worked at, the average client was around for 4 months. So imagine that sales cycle. Like it takes 60 days to onboard them. They get 30 days worth of work and they're like, this sucks. And then 30 days to offboard. The average client was 4 months, right? And I'm like, imagine if I just did this, but I kept them for a year. I'm like, I'll make so much money, right? So I started an ad agency. I have 10 clients.
So you're saying this like it's simple. So you're working at an ad agency. How old are you roughly at this time?
I was 22.
You're 22 years old. You're not like a marketing expert yet, right? You're like, you know, you're learning on the job, I would assume.
Yeah. But like it was it's kind of like TikTok shops is today. Like nobody's an expert, right? Like it's a brand new thing that came out. Like we're probably 2.5 years into Facebook ads. People still thought Instagram followers were the most important metric. And they're like wanting to run campaigns to get followers, right?
And was your agency super bullish on Facebook as a channel, or it was kind of like this new thing that, you know, you got really interested in because it was new, but was the whole agency like, hey, this is going to be a really big deal?
Yeah, it was like a cookie cutter D2C agency, like in the heyday. This is probably like 2015, right? So Facebook and email was the services we were providing. Like there was no other services. Maybe there was one guy doing Google ads, right? But it was really all in on Facebook as like this brand new channel. And if I could go back in time, I would have been even deeper into Facebook. Like the biggest challenge with Ridge, we're skipping a couple of years in the future, but like we try to diversify too fast. Like I was doing newsletter sponsorships and like they worked. I should have put all of my dollars into Facebook back then up until like 2020. I would have just been better off putting as much money into that as possible. But
and Ridge was one of your clients. Were they an early client?
Yeah, so I had 10, so I'm at an agency, it sucks, I think I can do a better job. Me and my CMO, Connor, we ended up starting an agency together. We take 10 clients with us. 8 of them you have never heard of, okay? Like, they've just, you know, gone extinct. One of them was Ridge, and then one of them was actually Mudwater, which has actually gone on to crush it. Like, we did their Google ads at some point, like in 2016 or whatever. But yeah, so we end up taking Ridge over. Father, son, best friend, they start this business. They get to like $5 million a year in sales. And they are, you know, like the dad was a special ed teacher. Like, you know, Daniel was going to go to be an accountant and this thing just kind of caught fire. And he really didn't want to be an accountant. So like their expectations for the brand when they got to $5 million a year, they're like, this is the best thing that's ever happened, right? And me and Connor being hella young, and I'm like, I think we can get to $15 million a year. I think we can get this thing to $30 million a year. I remember telling Connor, I'm like, I think we can do $100 million a year selling this wallet. And he looks me dead in the face and he's like, there is no fucking way in hell we're going to do that, right? This was like 2017. But they didn't really want to run it all that much anymore, right? Like they didn't want to manage people. So I'm like, cool, we'll do everything else. So my agency kind of gets built around running Ridge Wallet. We do their customer service. We do their product importation. We do all of their marketing. We do their web dev. And then I'm charging them like $200,000 a month. Like all of the money is coming from Ridge Wallet. They end up being like 60% of all agency billables for my tiny agency. And at a certain point, they're like, hey, we should just merge, right? So me and Connor take an equity stake. Everyone in my agency just goes in-house to Ridge. I end up selling off the agency to one of the people who was running it. And that was probably 2018. And since then, Ridge has gone from, you know, $30 million a year to over 200.
That's amazing.
All right, here's the deal. If HubSpot tripled the price, I'd be screwed. The reason I would be screwed is because my entire company is run on HubSpot.com. My website, my email marketing, my dashboards, how I track my customers, literally everything. And if they tripled the price, I would pay them more money. And that's because the product is so freaking powerful. My entire company is built on it. And so if you're running a business and you want to grow faster, you want to grow better, you want to be more organized, check it out, HubSpot.com. All right, back to the pod.
What I love about that story is that it sounds like when you were running the agency, like almost like nobody would in a business school would recommend, hey, you're running this marketing agency. And then for one client, you're going to start doing customer service, you know, logistics support, all these other things. It sounds like wrong to do that. It's like, wow, one customer is going to make up 60% of your billables. From a business school perspective, that would be like a bad move. But Dharmesh said something once on the podcast. He goes, with my first business, he goes, I got mixed up later. He goes, just because I was ignorant doesn't mean I was wrong. Meaning I didn't know the right way to do it, but my instincts actually were leading me in the right direction. It just wasn't, I didn't have like some sophisticated game plan, and maybe it wasn't typical, but it was, my instincts were correct. And it sounds like your instincts were correct that you should just keep leaning into the Ridge thing, even though it was like maybe not what a normal marketing agency ever would have done.
Most clients suck. Like if you guys have ever done client work, like most clients fight with you, they don't pay you, like they're always trying to fire you, right? And Ridge as a business was ran by really cool guys who didn't want to take any like reins away from us. They were very happy with the $5 million a year business. And they're like, we could always go back to shipping the orders ourselves, right? Like, I mean, the guys are like, you know, Buddhist, like raised Buddhist their whole lives. I think that's part of it. But they were very much like, hey, this is a good thing. These guys are growing this business. Let's give them more responsibility. And, you know, you can't really exit agency businesses for all that much, right? One reason why we went all in on Ridge and did the merger is like an agency is probably worth maybe 1x client contracts. And like maybe at the peak, it was 2x client contracts, right? So like if your clients, you know, if you have a guaranteed $1 million in revenue, you might be able to sell it for $1 million or $2 million. Where Ridge at the time, we're like fucking $10 billion year business right here. We're going to grow this thing to the fucking moon. So it just made sense to put all our chips in that basket.
What was the metric that you saw that gave you the aha moment where you were like, all right, they're doing 5 million now, but this could be 30, this could be 100. Was there one or two metrics or was it just a guess? What was that research process like?
It just seemed like they could always put another dollar into Facebook and it could work, right? Like the limiting factor wasn't like marketing or awareness. It was like the operations of the business, right? We ended up like, we had a year where we didn't have any wallets because we couldn't keep them in stock. So like we went from 15 million to 18 million 1 year. And that was just because we couldn't make enough of the fucking product. And I'm like, you know, so often demand is the thing that stops these brands. Like you can only get to so big of a TAM. And that wasn't the case here. You know, we did like a wearable and it was so hard to get people to buy the wearable. Like the CAC on Facebook was $400 back then, okay? It was like so fucking hard to get people to buy these wearables where the wallet, it was like a $6 CAC. Like we could just put up a new ad and they were just static images and they were just selling. So that was the metric, man.
That's like an interesting process because a lot of people, myself included, will say focus, 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 get it right, make it great. It's going to take a decade plus. But your story is more so like, I tried this, I tried this, I tried this. None of it worked. This thing was clearly the winner. I should go all in on this. Is that what your recommendation is?
Well, my recommendation as a person trying to make it is you should make the best decision at the time. So whatever the facts are, when the facts change, make a different decision, right? Strong beliefs held loosely. So like, I'm at an agency. I could have just like did that grind and be like, I'm going to be a VP at this agency when I'm 26, I'll make like 200 grand a year. But I was like, no, these people suck. I think the best decision for me is to just do what they're doing better. Right. And then from the agency to Ridge, I'm like running an agency business. I'm like running an agency sucks. The Ridge thing seems to be going better. So I should just do that instead. I should find a way to entrench myself inside of this business. And then at Ridge, it was just like, I mean, for so long, we did not launch any other products. For 8 years, it was just selling more of the wallet because that's what was working. As soon as it started to get a little hard, then we pivoted to everything else.
Which is funny because I would have thought early on, I would have the paralysis of analysis would have been like, well, there's not that many wallet. Like if you told me $200 million a year in revenue, I would say, well, you've sold every man in America a wallet. Like there are no more wallet buyers. You know what I mean? That's like one of my uneducated self-limiting belief a little bit would have been on that. If you said 200 million a year, I'm like, well, there are no more people who need a wallet.
Dude, it's a weirdly big TAM. Like the reason why, like we in, you know, in retrospect, I could tell you all the reasons why Ridge Wallet worked. It's a $10 billion a year TAM, okay? And like most of that is luxury brands. LVMH sells like $4 billion a year in men's wallets. Like Keurig, they own Gucci, they sell a ton of men's wallets. But then Tapestry, which owns Coach, Coach does $1 billion a year in men's sales. So that's men's accessories. No men are buying those products. They're all gifts that are given to them. And nobody's ever excited about getting those products. So the reason why like I'm very public that I think Ridge can get to $1 billion in revenue is because Tapestry has a men's business doing $1 billion a year in revenue with nobody loyal or passionate about that. So I'm just going to make whatever they make in all of our cool colors and our cool materials. And, you know, I think it's been so sexy to be talking about tech and AI these past 10 years, right? Or, you know, tech for 10 years, AI for 10 months. But I was at like the All In Summit and I'm looking at those guys and like the products they're talking about exist inside their phones, right? Like they exist inside some server somewhere, but they're all wearing fucking cool suits and watches and leather belts. And I'm like, okay, I'll just sell them all that shit, right? Like I'm just going to sell like all the, like the most practical thing ever, because also smart people don't enter the space, right? The reason why Ridgewallet was able to be so successful is because we're the only people running Facebook ads for wallets. Like, then there's been a bunch of other like people who've started up and like and have tried. They've all ended up going out of business because it's really difficult to get right, right? Like, there is no repeat business. You can't like believe that the LTV will come save you later. It's very much like, can you tactically acquire customers profitably every single day?
Hey, Brown Sean, White Sean's got that immigrant energy that I love. He's got, you know what I mean? Like,
he's got the, what do you call it? The Korean restaurant owner?
I call it a Korean convenience store owner energy. You know, it's just like, there's not like too much overthinking it. It was like, well, you guys are all wearing this. I'll just sell that.
Right.
You know
right. what I mean? Like, yeah. And I think you'll keep wearing this. So, you know, Munger has these great quotes where he's like, his main thing is like, instead of trying to be brilliant, just avoid stupidity. Or he'll be like, you know, the best thing in the world is stupid competition. And we just have not much and stupid competition. It sounds like that's part of what, in retrospect, made Ridge work, was you were like, hey, look, we took the simple idea. And there's not a lot of other really smart, you know, D2C marketers that were doing this. And so we were able to make hay.
Yeah, totally, man. I mean, and to this day, the best D2C marketers are working on stuff like, you know, AG1, right? Like, they're selling supplements. And it's because it's a better business. Like, undoubtedly, if there's an LTV tied to your business, like, it's going to be better, it's going to be more valuable, it's going to trade at a higher multiple. But the other thing is, like, the best marketers have more or less left the industry, right? Like, in 2021, running an e-com brand was incredibly cool. It has gotten less cool every single year. So there's less people doing it. There's less voices. There's less people talking about it. And it's because it's fucking hard. Like, I'm unjokingly call it like the blue collar work. It's like, you know, everyone wants to be shipping cool AI products, or everybody wants to be shipping, you know, something that isn't physical boxes to people's doors of products you actually have to like make. Everyone wants to build, you know, the services of whatever. So anyway, yeah, over the past 4 years, it's gotten really uncool to do what I do.
Do you guys, on $200 million in revenue, are you able to make a good cash flow and profit? Or, you know, I know so many friends who have these companies and their numbers are huge, but cash is always an issue. Are you able to manage this well? And, or at that scale, do you still struggle?
I think the reason why you guys asked me to be here is to talk about the fact that you can, in fact, make a profit running e-commerce brands. So Ridge has never raised any money. We have no debt. So every dollar in this business, every dollar on my balance sheet is profit that has been reinvested. I've been able to make millions of dollars a year for the past couple of years running this business. So yeah, it can definitely be done, man. Like I bought a house in LA directly because of selling wallets on the internet.
Give us a sense of the timeline. So you said kind of like, I don't know, it was 2016-ish, right? When you guys merged or you took over the brand. But can you just give us kind of like a year one, $5 million when you started working with them, then it went to 10, then it went to 22, then it, you know, give us a timeline.
Yeah. And I'm fucking horrible at timelines. So I'll give it my best. It's basically been, it's like a 50% CAGR since I started working with the business. So I think they did a Kickstarter in 2013, the first year they do like $1 million in revenue. In 2015, they probably do 2 or 3. When I meet them, 2016, they do like $5 million. So I think it went from 5 to 10 to 15 to 18. And that's like the hardest year of the business. When it went from 15 to 18, that was like, we had no inventory with this massive fucking tax bill. That sucked. That was probably 2018 or 19 when that happened. 2020, we do $50 million. So that must have been 2018. It must have been 30. So 18 to 30 to 50. And then 50, this is the COVID year. So it went from 50 to 100. And then it's been like, yeah. I mean, last year was a multi-hundred million dollar year. So
let me recap that for the listener. So you started in 15, I didn't hear what you said, but in 2016, 5 million. And then each year after that was 5 million, 10, 15, 18, 30, 50, 100, with last year being multi-hundred. That's incredible growth.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. So it's been super fun, man. Sam, you brought up, have I sold every wallet in America? That was like one of your concerns, right? So like I said, it's a massive TAM, right? And I always say, like, we're a great uncle gift. Like, you guys are going to go to Christmas, or you guys are going to go to fucking a birthday or whatever, and you have to buy some guy in your life a present, and you don't know his size, right? The Ridge Wallet's a perfect price point. You can get one on sale today for, like, $76, and it is sizeless. And, like, every guy in your life, you'd be like, hey, look, it has your favorite sports team on it, or it has carbon fiber or whatever else, right? So it's a perfect uncle gift. And most of our products are probably sold as gifts, right? Some woman in their life buying it for some guy in their life. And the wallets are about half of revenue right now. The other half of revenue is all the other stuff we've launched. So the biggest unlock we've ever had was in 2022. We started selling men's wedding bands. And once again, this is a category where people thought I was so fucking dumb to sell men's wedding bands. They're like, it is a commodity good. Like, who the hell is buying this? The first year we do 8 figures. It is the highest margin, fastest growing part of my company is selling men's wedding bands on the internet.
So let's talk about this, because we're in this group chat that you have, which is like a bunch of DTC brands. I don't know what the cutoff is. I think I'm like below whatever the cutoff was supposed to be, but you let me in, which was nice of you.
You're and in the like the charisma hire.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the personality hire. So you talked about like going into new categories, and like the wedding band was obviously a smash success. You've said the wearable thing maybe wasn't as big of a success. And you had this kind of interesting way of looking at it, because I just thought Ridge Wallet's that kind of like the sort of carbon fiber metal wallet company. And you were talking about like Mont Blanc, and you were talking about these other almost like luxury accessory brands. And that was the vision you had for the company. When did that vision kick in? So like, when did you reframe what the company is? Because I think entrepreneurs, we hear stories where somebody already has the vision and they already have the right frame and it sounds beautiful and big and really appealing. But at the beginning, they don't always have that. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, there's a video of him on a couch somewhere and somebody's like, are you going to expand past colleges? He's like, nah, that wouldn't be cool. And now he's like got satellites above India, giving people internet so they can use Facebook. Like, you know, your vision expands as you grow. When did the vision kind of change, or when did you reframe it? And secondly, how do you think about going into new categories?
Yeah, well, I'm a very paranoid person. So like in 2018, I'm like, this is going to end. We have to fucking find some other shit to sell. So we got into backpacks and phone cases and all this stuff pretty early in 2018. And the first year we did like $4 million in backpack sales, or maybe it was $3 million. It was like a big chunk of revenue. And we canceled that program because I was too stupid to know that was like actually a good amount of backpacks. I was like, I'm like, the wall is doing $20 million. How come we can't do $20 million in backpacks? In retrospect, we've since relaunched backpacks. So I was just too stupid, right? So we were always looking for new products to sell, mostly because I was worried that I was going to sell every wallet to every man in America. But as you learn more about the industry, like the very common thing is very large holdcos holding lots of accessory brands. Like LVMH is just an accessory brand. Like everything inside their portfolio just sells accessories, mostly to women, but there are occasionally pop-ups of like very strong men's accessory brands. Mont Blanc is owned by Richemont, they own Cartier. Like that is the strongest men's accessory brand. And they do $500 million a year. You think it's gonna be pens. Pens were like 18% of revenue. It's mostly just like small leather goods, right? And it's across the world, people buying each other gifts, like wallets and backpacks and belts and everything else. So there's a playbook here. It's like, you have to find a group of customers who like you. You have to like continue to make products that they like and sell it into them. And I am more ruthless with product expansion than I think a lot of brands are. And I think more people should just try. They're really worried about hurting brand. And I'm like, your customers never fucking think about you. Like you're lucky if somebody is mad you launched something. Like, you know, I always go to like Bic is one of my favorite brands. Like they make lighters and they make pens and they make razors, right? And we buy all of those products independently and they're best in class.
I didn't even think of those three. Saying that, I'm like, oh, it's same.
Yeah, yeah. And they're the best in class in all three of those. If you want a disposable razor or a cheap pen or a lighter, that's the only one. They own those markets. And it's just because the guy had a plastic factory and he's like, it's a French company. And they got into tattoo removal now, right? Like they're making like, they just bought a bunch of tattoo companies because they're like, yeah, whatever takes plastic, we're just going to do those things, right? And it doesn't violate anything in your brain because you just like that's just the way it's always been. So I think it's more elastic than a lot of people want to admit. And brands die by being too rigid by that. Like Allbirds should have got into fucking betting and like all these different type of things, but they didn't. So now they're just a fucking dead shoe company, right? Like, you should just be so ruthless with that product expansion.
All right, folks, this is a quick plug for a podcast called I Digress. If you're trying to grow your business but feel like you're drowning in buzzwords and BS, then check out the I Digress podcast. It's hosted by this guy named Troy Sandage. He's helped launch over 35 brands and drive $175 million in revenue. So if you want to get smarter about scaling your business, listen to I Digress wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the pod. You're a very charismatic guy. You have a lot of interesting parts of your personality that I enjoy. What attributes would you say are most responsible for the Ridge's success, you think?
One, it's a very trust-forward organization. It's a very transparent organization. When I say trust-forward, six of us own it. You know, three of them are father, son, best friend, like literally would die for each other. And then me and my CMO, Connor, I lived with him for fucking 5 years. Like the guy, I was talking last night, there was a time when we were running the agency where we did not have $1,000. Like we would have to take, his dad gave him a car and it was like a 1997 Honda Civic that smelled and like paint was peeling, windows didn't work. We would take it to meetings. We would have to park it behind buildings so people didn't see us get out of this fucking junky car. And, you know, tying it to that, it's like not being scared to go back to zero, right? Like I'm from like a very poor, bad area where kids died of fentanyl overdoses. And like I lived in a flop house with like fucking, like there was like 14 guys living in bunk beds when I moved to LA. And so I'm like, dude, not scared to go back there. So just more willing to take risks. Things are never that bad. Also being willing to eat shit. I'm like, bro, if I have to fucking be a waiter, we'll figure it out, right? Yeah. So that fortitude, like not being like so ego tied to whatever the fuck you're doing. If I have to pack boxes, I'm gonna pack boxes, right?
What are the ways people get e-com wrong? So we talked about Allbirds, right? It was a product that was hot. And now the stock is, you know, dead. There's, you know, a bunch of other kind of famous examples of that. And then there's companies like yours, which is keep scaling profitably, you know, never took a dollar of debt, never took a dollar of investment and made it work. What are the kind of, give us like your version of the do's and don'ts. And maybe just start with the don'ts, like the dumb shit that people do, the bad decisions that people make, or the common traps you see people fall into. Because I'm sure, you know, that's your network is e-com. So you see the full spectrum. People who totally flop, people who grind away for years and get nothing out of it, and people who excel and succeed.
Yeah, so you can't outmuscle a TAM. So like, understand what you're selling and how big the market actually is. I see amazing operators waste time with horrible opportunities, right? Like the TAM is what the TAM is. And if you're like the number one fucking garlic press seller, like that's kind of a meme in the community, like, dude, I'm like, and you're executing ruthlessly to be the number one garlic press seller, that is worse than being the 12th best creatine gummy, right? Because that market is exponentially growing, there's LTV tied to it, like so many people just waste energy and time on these horrible fucking product categories. So you can't beat a TAM. You're not better than the trend. So bone broth, there was companies that exploded, got to $80 million in revenue. It was like, dude, this is the new way people are going to consume calories, bone broth. That is now at a 30-year low because that's not the cool thing anymore, right?
People Same with moved. Keto stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a guy from IQ Bar. His name's Will. He's incredibly smart. He talks about his trend surface area. So it's like, look, people talk about their luck surface area. He's like, I make products to have as much trend surface area as possible. So if keto's hot, I'll be keto. If gluten-free is hot, I'll be gluten-free. If it's sugar that's cool or non-sugar, like whatever, I'll make those products to just hit whatever the trend is, and I'll just change my packaging so I'm always top of trend. And you're not better than the trend, right? So like that's the point I'm trying to make, is you can ride it up, but as soon as it crashes, you'll crash with it. And then my third one, the most controversial one, is that LTV isn't real. Like, lifetime value only works if you're alive. So most brands die waiting for LTV, right?
And what you mean by that is you got to be profitable early on that customer you acquired. If you acquire the customer for $200 and you only made, you know, $20 and you're saying, oh, the LTV, it'll all pay off. That's kind of what you're talking about, right? Versus the way you guys do it is you're trying to be profitable either first purchase, or are you guys profitable first purchase, or is it like, you know, a month or two later? Where are you guys at?
dude, I have to be profitable in the first purchase. You think people are coming back to buy a second wallet in a month? It's like, I'm like, dude, the LTV from wallet customers is like, maybe in 90 days, I get 10%. So like, it's very much, I have to turn not a contribution margin, like actual true paying for all my fixed costs every time I sell a wallet to somebody.
Can we play a game called Change My Opinion? And this is for both of you guys. I have a bone to pick with your industry. I think Sean's heard me with this spiel before. What frustrates me sometimes, not exactly you guys, but I'm going to use you as an example, but of people who, all they worry about is like the CAC and the LTV and the TAM of these industries, and they don't spend any time actually thinking, is this product awesome? Is this the best? You know, like, is this truly solving a problem? And it bothers me sometimes that it's more of an arbitrage, not exactly thinking about, can I create a widget that makes a customer's life better and is of high quality? I wish that more people in this industry sort of talked about that a bit more. Do you think that's a fair criticism, or where am I wrong on this?
Dude, no, I mean, I think it's a fair criticism. My industry has been washed out, though. So like, the people you're talking about probably have all left. It's there's so few people left in e-com. Like Sean brought up the group chat. Maybe two people respond every single day, and one of them's Meetab. Like, it's like we're at like a multi-year low of interest in the industry. So like, yeah, all those people have left. The people who are still here in shipping, dude, I bring up Hexclad. You guys want to talk about like amazing?
Yeah.
So like, I'm very close.
You tweet about them all the time, and like, they inspired me because you said they like worked for 3 years finding the perfect pan.
Okay, so when I met Danny, it was 2020. They didn't have a website. He says they did, but like, you couldn't check out on the fucking website, okay? They were fucking selling pans at trade shows and like county fairs, cooking up eggs themselves, right? In Costco Roadshow. So not even in Costco. They had to pay to show up at Costco and fucking cook up these eggs. And they, from 2020, they'll do, I mean, it's documented at this point, over $500 million a year. Like, they got to hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in annual turnover with 100 million plus in profit. Danny will fucking shoot me for saying all this stuff, but like, I think it's all pretty rare public. You know, Gordon joined the brand. They have Fox as an investor now. But pre all that, they were doing 9 figures in EBITDA a year. Okay.
Didn't Gordon Ramsay like write a huge check? He didn't just like sort of join the brand. He like invested a pretty sizable amount, or was he part of a round, or was it him personally investing in it?
That's all public. There's like a thing. He came in with Fox on some thing, and like, you know, because Fox, it's like a three-way deal. Fox wants to give him money to make shows, and he wants to get more equity in Hexclad. So it's like a big three-way deal.
Gotcha. But, dude, I have like 12 Hexclad pans in my
Are they awesome,
right now.
Sean?
They're great. You know, I don't know if they're the best pans, because I don't try 100 pans. But they're way better than the pans I had That's before, awesome. And to the point where I bought a second set of them because I was like, these are great. I'm happy with these pans.
Yeah, and they put years into the product development. Like, they actually they care about their customers. What it comes down to is respecting your customers. If you're just like, that's why I don't like info products. Like, if you don't respect your customers, if you're just like trying to arb them, or like, you know, we have a customer name. So our customer is Everyday Dad. We call him Ed. And I'm like, almost every meeting, I'm like, are we respecting Ed? Are we delivering value to Ed, right? Everyone has an Ed in their life. Think about like your guys' brothers or your dads. He's just like a guy, he likes widgets and like he loves fishing and like he loves NFL. Like, that's fucking Ed. And I'm like, look, Ed has paid for everything in my entire life. We need to take care of Ed. We want to make sure Ed gets like the best, coolest shit possible, that we give him great value and great deals. And that's what Hexclad did. And like, when we talk about like, I think this industry gets a bad rap because so many people have entered it and so few people have left with any amount of money. Or like, the people who did leave with money, like it was like a greater fool theory. They were just tricking somebody to give them money and then they bailed out. But then there's companies like Hexclad where they'll be a 50-year brand. They'll be a generational brand and they're fucking crushing it. So it's possible. They're buying Super Bowl ads. Like, I mean, this is, you know, they were bootstrapped up until like 2 years ago, like a bootstrap brand getting that done. It's fucking amazing.
Yeah, I think, Sam, what you said is true, that marketing skill is the core competency for most of the winners in this space. Most. There's a few, there's a couple who just really nailed product or community, right? And then they just they built slowly brick by brick over a decade. But for the most part, the people you'll hear about and the people you'll meet, they're great because they are great at doing Facebook ads and Google ads, or now TikTok content. And so that's true. But at the same time, you're like, oh, I hate that it's this CAC to LTV thing. Well, it's like, guess what? When you sit down with your team, you're like, how do we raise LTV? Right? Like, there's some natural gravity, like Sean's saying, like, you buy a wallet every 7 years. You're not really going to change that. But like for my product, you do buy it way more often. You know, in the first 6 months, we double the amount that they paid us on the first order, right? So it's really, it's a movable number, right? We can actually affect that. And then you're like, all right, well, how do we increase LTV? It's like, yeah, you could spam them with emails. You could spam them with text messages. But guess what? The better way to do it is to make an amazing product that they're going to want to buy again, and like lower the return rate. How do you lower the return rate to get more profit, right? It's like, make a better quality product. And so I think that for anybody who's actually going to try to win, you will have to make an amazing product. Otherwise, you won't be able to do the ad arbitrage you're trying to do, because how else could you increase the LTV if everyone hates your product or it's not doing anything for them? And so, you know, I think the people who stick around and actually win in the long run are the ones who do what you...
Yeah, I think those are good answers to the question. I think that, when I see someone making like a boost your testosterone like thing, or I'm like, dude, I don't know if any of this works, or if they're just really good at making a label that's appealing. And so I like start to lose confidence in the industry as a whole.
Oh, totally.
I'm actually curious if you guys have any of these like D2C brands where you're like, this product is amazing. And so it's actually really good to hear that Hexclad is one of them. Do you guys have any other favorites?
Well, going back to the supplement side, a lot of it is like, I mean, a lot of this work is being done for like the co-manufacturers, right? Like there's co-packers that actually do all the formulation. So a lot of times people are just showing up and buying stuff off the shelf. So if you're getting any sort of supplement, like it's probably the same supplement white labeled 100 times. And that's just like the way the industry works. So, you know, I would put hard goods in a special category. And like, we talk about D2C brands. I mean, all of my favorite fashion brands are small and independently owned, right? Like, does that count? Like, this is Buck Mason. These pants are James Purse, right? Like, I just got a suit from Billy Reed. Like, these are all small, independently owned companies, right, that are running. They have Shopify websites. Does that count as D2C, right? It's very much like there's a black box of bad rap products. And I think a lot of it is supplements that come from co-mans, right? Or anything to do in the health and wellness space. Like that is like typically where there's a bunch of shit. But if you buy a Ridge wallet, you're going to get what is on the package. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Or one of our phone cases or whatever. It's like a fucking phone case, man. Like it's pretty good.
What who else is crushing it? So what are some D2C brands that we wouldn't know, or we wouldn't really realize how well they're doing, just because we're not in the space, we're not paying attention?
Yeah, the other reason you guys called me here to talk about the Woobles, okay? The Woobles is fucking crushing it.
The Woobles. Okay, so what are the Woobles?
So yeah, we are three young adult men. We're not the core customer, right? It is a crocheting product. So it is like you make little characters and they have licensing and like there's little education. It's like basically like either it's, you know, young people doing it to have less screen time, or it's you're doing it with your kids so they have less screen time. And that's
awesome.
Product, yeah. Dude, when I met them, they might have been doing $10 million a year. Like in 2 years, they've gone from 10 to probably $150 million in revenue. Like, no capital raised. They are still, and I like them and I respect them. They will not fucking launch subscription boxes. They're like, yeah, we don't think it's that important. I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. Like if I could shoot these people, I would, because they won't do subscription. It's like the perfect product. Like it is just educational. It's fun. It's connecting with your family. Like it's this movement against screen time, which is like a big trend that they can take advantage of. There's every month they could have new characters. They could just show up in your door. You do them. There's a little community aspect. It's the single best brand and execution that I've ever seen. Like this will be a $1 billion exit because they're so fucking good at it. They've never raised any goddamn money. Just like it's two people just putting it together in North Carolina.
How did they even think of this? Like, how did this get on the road? Were they big crocheters? What is the origin story of this?
Yeah. So I think it's a husband or wife team. I think she was just crocheting. And she's like, yeah, I would love to have little guides. And there was like an Etsy community of people like selling crochet guides. And she's like, she would buy them. And then she'd be like, okay, I'm going to make my own. And then she would, you know, release them. And then it's like, oh, maybe I should just sell my little crochet kits. And bam, fucking explodes, dude. So like, if you're listening to this and you're thinking like, okay, I'm not washed out. I want to try e-commerce. I highly recommend getting into services first, okay? Like, you should learn how to make money on the internet via services. And if the show's called My First Million, you'll make your first $1 million delivering good value to people like me or like Woobles, whoever else. Then find a trend that's very fast emerging, right? Like, I think no screen time, I think creatine, those are the two biggest ones for the next 2 or 3 years. Like, if you can do a no screen time creatine crochet kit, something, fucking, you'll figure it out, right?
Dude, I've spent so much money on Legos lately for that no screen time trend. What are other no screen time products?
I feel like the microplastics is another trend, right? Like,
and air quality.
Yeah. Dude, yeah, so like, just glass, everything, glass bottles, glass containers, whatever. Just like, imagine if you could just buy a backpack and they're like, we guarantee there's no plastic in it. Fucking awesome. Just wrap it in paper, ship it to people. That's another trend I think is going to be fast emerging. Yeah, no screen time, just more physical tactical toys, right? Like bringing back the fidget spinner, but as like a focus tool, right? Like, I think there's a bunch of shit you could do in there. But anyway, those are fast emerging trends right now. Protein was a trend that's basically probably dead, right? Pre-protein was collagen. There's always these just like pockets of success you'll find. And that's the beauty of the space. It's like,
you know what it is right now in that space? What's the early boob milk? What's that called? Colostrum?
Colostrum. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm getting so many ads for colostrum.
Yeah. You know, the other one will be like, I think raw honey. It had like a small moment. I'm sure it's going to come back, right? There's like a bunch of New Zealand honey companies.
And if you were a founder, where would you kind of look for these? Are you a proponent of look in your own life? What are you doing or what is your wife doing that seems unusual, but actually there's a passionate community? Are you like, I scour Etsy and Reddit? Is that where you would look? How would you do this if you didn't know which trend to start with?
Right. So you should look in your own life because you probably don't have the skills to actually go out there and like, you know, or I'm assuming you have no resources to actually pick a trend and double down and actually deliver on those promises, right? So you should find something in your own life that you actually know and are passionate about. If you're a more seasoned professional, I think you can find those things, right? And really what it would be is, I think Reddit's dead. I think Etsy's dead. Like, that's AI slop basically at this point. The inshittification of the internet has happened to those two websites. I would look at literally what's happening inside of Irwan. Like, I would just move to LA and go to Irwan every single day because those are the best people at catching trends. Like, they were anti-vax in fucking 1997, right? Like, that's like they are very, very early on those things. And if you're not going to do that, then it's like you have to follow the girlies on TikTok, right? Like, the other one I bring up is Pilates. Like, Pilates was a thing in 2000. It's having a massive resurgence right now. And like, once again, we're three young men. How are we going to fucking make a Pilates brand? But Pilates for guys probably could be another trend.
Just needs a new name.
Yeah, totally. Well, Laplace, I think, is what the actual name is. Legree, something like that. My wife knows. But yoga is very much a downward trend, right? And like, this yoga was just a synonym for health and wellness and like, you know, non just jack dudes weightlifting. I think that's actually changing and it'll be something else like Pilates or something else.
New York City founders, if you've listened to My First Million before, you know I've got this company called Hampton. And Hampton is a community for founders and CEOs. A lot of the stories and ideas that I get for this podcast, I actually got it from people who I met in Hampton. We have this big community of 1,000+ people, and it's amazing. But the main part is this 8-person core group that becomes your board of advisors for your life and for your business, and it's life-changing. Now, to the folks in New York City, I'm building a in real life core group in New York City. And so if you meet one of the following criteria, your business either does $3 million in revenue, or you've raised $3 million in funding, or you've started and sold a company for at least $10 million, then you are eligible to apply. So go to joinhampton.com and apply. I'm going to be reviewing all of the applications myself. So put that you heard about this on MFM so I know to give you a little extra love. Now, back to the show. What are some other going up and going down? Give me like a topic or a trend and tell me, is this a buy or sell moment?
Well, look, this is not a hot take. This is not Scott Galloway fucking, but all big box department stores. Like, it's very, very much like we just saw Joann's Fabric go down. We just saw Container Store go down. We just saw Party City. Like, that's going to accelerate. Like, we are over commercial real estate. There's too many big box stores. Like, even Target is having a really fucking hard time. And my biggest wholesaler is Best Buy. I crush it in Best Buy. But all of that shit is probably, the FUD isn't real enough. It should be even more real. Like, Nordstrom's, Macy's. Like, I think small independent brick and mortar shops really do work. Like, if you're in LA, you go to Century City. Like, but I was walking around Bloomingdale's and, you know, like 10 years ago, it was, or even 20 years ago, probably, it was like the number one place to buy women's fashion, like women contemporary fashion. It was the coolest thing ever. I'm walking around, they got blouses that are $800 and it's dead on a Saturday. Like, nobody's fucking shopping there at the best mall in LA. So I think the FUD isn't even, we should be even more scared that there's going to be more collapses and any sort of commercial real estate that's like 10,000 square feet plus that is like selling physical goods. The other one is probably better for you, candy. Like, there's like VCs have really backed this like better for you artificial sugar. Like, you go to a fucking Target, like there's all of these like weird artificial sugar brands. I think it's going to come out that causes cancer and RFK is going to be pretty against it. So anyway, I'm probably not launching anything in there. Probably launching real sugar. And that's a very hot take that could age really bad, that like real sugar is going to make a massive resurgence.
What do you think about like, you know, these like other people who do the same model you did, services to products? So for example, I think the guys behind Brez, which is that, I think it's a, I don't know what it is, like a mushroom drink, or it's like an adaptogenic drink. It's basically, it's like, it gives you a high, but it's not alcohol. It's like
it's
mushrooms
a weed
or
drink.
Weed or something.
Their website says Brez is microdosed cannabis and mushrooms in a can.
Yeah. It's a weed drink. Really? Okay, great. So it's a weed drink. Those guys were agency people, right?
I begged to be the first check in Brez. There's screenshots where they said they were working on it. I'm like, let me be the first check, because Aaron is incredibly smart. He was the first person to figure out how to work with Meta to have controlled substances be advertised. So like that's like his specialty. Like, if you had a cannabis company, you had to go through him and his agency called We Are Lucid to actually do the cannabis advertising on Meta, right? He found a compliant way to do it. So he's incredibly smart. Nick's an amazing operator, ran a great agency. That's the best model. The other person is Zach, from Homestead. He has a company called Hollow Socks. Like, I don't know how much time we have, but to unpack the history of e-commerce 1.0, selling random shit on the internet, okay? Like, whatever, pets.com. E-commerce 2.0 was marketplaces. It was eBay versus Amazon versus everything else. E-commerce 3.0 is what we consider DTC 1.0, which was like the first brands coming online, the Allbirds, whatever else. Then you get DTC 2.0, which was the COVID hotness, the peak, everything exploding, right? We are now in DTC 3.0, which is small service providers pivoting to brands with very lean teams, and Create Gummies, Hollow Socks, Brez, the three best examples. Create Gummies has a team of 8 people. I think they'll do $40 million this year, right? Hollow Socks is a team of 5 people. They'll do $30 million this year selling socks, mostly off of Meta ads, right? And then Brez, they're public with their numbers. Follow Aaron on LinkedIn. And I think they did $5 million last month in revenue, okay? In beverage, in a controlled substance, that's fucking insane. Like, that company's worth $300 million today, right? And I think their team's incredibly small, maybe 20 people at this point. So, that is the best bull case for e-commerce right now. Service operators who've seen like the rise and fall of all these different brands, have learned from them, have spent their money to get good at ads, right? Launching targeted, hyper-specific brands. And the three I named. are the best.
Sean, you should go to drinkbrez.com. Do you see their website? That's the prettiest website I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, that's usually not a good thing. The prettiest websites are not usually the ones that work the best.
But I hear you, and I am on board with that. This is one of the exceptions. Look at this.
But I think what happens is you see the front of the house is not always where the traffic is going. So, the front of the house is kind of the hero. It's the brand. It's the aspirational. But you run your ads, and maybe you're running straight to a PDP or to a TikTok shop or to different things like that. I think they're very heavy into TikTok, right? Like their model is the TikTok blueprint, which we just did an episode with Rob from Rob the Bank about, like the TikTok blueprint that a bunch of the brands are using right now. And I think Brez is doing that, where it's organic. It's kind of the TikTok affiliate / organic model, where you're getting really cheap CPMs because TikTok videos can just pop off, and you're putting out thousands of pieces of content a month, but it's driving sales. Unlike the way I've been doing it, or you've been doing it, Sean, which is like a lot of Facebook, Google ads. You put a dollar in, it's attributed exactly how much that ad generated in revenue, and you just sort of optimize from there. The TikTok game is a little bit different. It's a bit of a spray and pray game for the most part.
Yeah, so I just sent you guys, this is from Aaron from Brez. They did $4.6 million in revenue in month 21, January. This is their LinkedIn post. So this is all public information that they share. TikTok shop was $37,000. Amazon revenue was $342,000. I'm not going to read this for the audience. Maybe you'll just show it. But dude, they're fucking killing it. Brez is awesome.
Well, they post their P&L basically every month on... it's not an actual P&L, but sort of a marketing P&L on Twitter and LinkedIn. It's great. So we could read this. So total net revenue, $4.5 million. Let's see. That's in, you said month 21 now?
Yeah, dude. And that's literally. Insane.
Then their ads. They spent $1 million on Facebook, $400,000 on Google. On TikTok ads, they spent zero. But I know that they must be spending on the affiliate part of TikTok, because if I'm on TikTok, I see Brez stuff all the time, and it's always an affiliate link. Swipe up, and you can sort of buy it from there. AppLovin, $472,000.
It really seems like one of the keys to this business, and this is not always the case, but it's picking the right idea. The right idea and the right angle, it seems like there's no other way to explain how something can get to $4 million in monthly revenue in 21 months.
Yeah. I mean, and the reason they were able to be right is because they're both agency operators, right? Like the right people to launch a product like this. And also it's so hard. The reason why they're willingly sharing their P&L is they have nothing to hide, and they don't think you can beat them, right? And I think anybody listening to this can't beat them, because—
Are they shutting down their agency, or are they just going to keep trying to do both? Like, why would you run your agency once this happens?
Yeah. I mean, you end up just selling it off or hiring operators. I mean, Nick Shackelford, which was the partner in Brez, I mean, he had, an events business, he had an agency business, he had an email business. I think you find partners to take that over, and you just put more time into this. But I mean, early on, I was willing to bet on these fucking guys because they're the best.
Sam, I want you to Google Nick Shackelford tattoo and tell me if you want to compete with this guy.
Oh my God. His whole body is covered.
Yeah.
From the neck down to his toe, every inch of his body is covered in a tattoo.
He looks like
the guy from Prison Break, dude.
Yeah, he looks like a Japanese murderer. How they do the Yakuza? They do the whole, that's insane.
Included his dick. I mean, he actually got it done, man. He said it was so painful.
Oh my God.
It looks horrible. I mean, it looks great, but I don't want to do it.
It looks painful.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's insane. What do you think Ridge is worth right now?
Oh man, I mean, The market for a brand like us is at an all-time low. And look.
Well, what's the all-time low number?
We'd probably, a market clearing price is probably $300 million. I could probably clear that at the market with our growth and everything. It's really hard to sell my business right now. And I'm not trying to sell my business right now, right? I think we have by the end of the decade, we'll be doing $500 or $600 million a year in annual revenue. really driven by this big tech rollout. So like, we're really big in Best Buy already. We're going to be in Apple. We're going to be in Verizon, selling power banks, phone cases, cables. We already sell our wallets in a lot of those places. So that's like the next evolution of the brand, is just more product expansion. But it's hard for me to sell my brand when Solo Stove is in a public company. And I think they're worth maybe $100 million on the public market, right? Like they peaked at $2.1 billion and now they're probably... The market cap today is 100 million. And they have like 400 plus million in revenue. They own Chubbies. Like, it's very hard for my brand to go to market when, if you squint, we kind of look like them. And they just need to be taken private. There's a lot of take private needs to happen. And interest rates are still too high to take a lot of stuff private. So we're just waiting for all that.
What would you want to sell if you weren't doing Ridge? If you had to sell Ridge today, what other product? I mean, you're not a guy who would stop. What other product would you want to sell?
Yeah, my goal for Ridge, eventually I'm not the long-term shepherd of this brand. Like if it's going to go public or whatever, or most likely get bought by one of the roll-ups, like in our industry, that's the exit path. There's 10 strategics that end up buying brands like ours. I would like to net $100 million, and then I would like to start a portfolio of brands and services, basically. Like, you know, everyone wants to have their own little PE, their own little family office type thing. So I would launch a bunch of weird little e-commerce brands that I think are going to be trend relevant, and hire service providers to run those businesses.
I love that you know what you want. You know, you've mapped this out of like what your ideal setup is. I love that. I love people who call their shot.
Do you talk about trends like, but you know, bone broth, it's hot, then it's not. Keto, it's hot, then it's not. And so like, why go after a trend if it's going to ultimately, you know, do what trends do? Most trends don't last forever. So is that like building your sandcastle, you know, building your castle on quicksand or something like that? Like why go after a trend when trends have this like shelf life? Are you trying to time an exit, or are you trying to, you're going to hop trends? What's the plan if you're going to build on top of a trend?
Yeah, dude, going back to Will from IQ Bar, trend surface area. Like you create a product in a trend because that's the best way to grow is in a growing market. You can be average in a growing market and grow very, very fast, right? I was an average operator when Facebook ads were growing, and that's why my business grew. Now I can be a good operator because I have to be, right? But when a market's growing very fast, you could just be average. And then once you get some sort of success, it's pivoting. So like if I was in the bone broth business, I would have told them like, hey, we have to do fucking protein-focused bone broths or bone bars. Like I'm that guy coming in here trying to like disrupt whatever fucking business I'm in. I'm like, if I was at bone broth, I'd be like, look, that's fine. We should do that. We're going to do bone bars and we're going to get whatever, some jacked guy to talk about how they're great. And then I'd be in the bars business. And then it'd be like, we got to do bone supplements. We got to be the only guys doing bone, whatever, marrow pills. Like that's the type of shit I'd be pitching to them. So
I love that that's your answer, because it's like, that's the attitude you have to win in that game. My takeaway is, man, what a horrible game to play. I was just doing a podcast yesterday with a guy, and he goes, you don't want to be in the fresh produce business. He's like, he's like, you want to be YouTube, not a YouTuber, right? Just as a simple example. He's like, you take the best YouTuber and they're in the fresh produce business. They have to keep running as fast as they can on that treadmill. And if the treadmill gets faster and faster every year, and if they stop, they fall behind, and there's 1,000 other people on that treadmill. And so same thing, like if you're on a trend, and a trend, you know, almost by definition is going to sort of peter out, and then the new trends will emerge. That just seems like a really hard way to win in business when there's other styles of businesses that don't have that problem, right?
But I think, so like, but Sean, I think you're both could be right. I think the right answer though is to whichever path you take should fit your skill set and interest, and you should commit to it and be that. You know, we had Moyes on, Moyes Ali from Native Deodorant, and we said, like, why don't you do something easier? He goes, because I'm a merchant. This is what I do.
And yeah, I think that stuff is silly, dude.
No, it's not silly. I actually disagree. I think committing to a path is significantly better than not. And if Sean Frank is committing to this trend thing, then it's exhausting for you because that's not your interest.
You can commit to a better path. That's not true.
What are you talking about? How much better path could it be? He's got a 10-year-old company that's doing $200 billion a year in revenue. That sounds like a good path.
Yeah, I'm not saying what he's doing is bad. I'm saying he's an outlier winner, And even he's like, yeah, there's a company that's like us that does $400 million a year and is worth $100 million on the public markets, right? Or, you know, we have to continually hop, you know, from one category to the next. And he's in a better one. It's more enduring. But let's say you're on the bone broth type of thing where it's a wellness trend. And the wellness trends or the diet trends, they change very, very, very rapidly, right? It's like, that's a hard game to play compared to, like, you know, look at the possible set of businesses you could go into. That's definitely on the hard side, dude. Like, e-com is definitely on the hard side. And e-com on top of a trend is the hard version of the hard version.
Oh, dude, look, I understand completely. But the reason why I'm in it is because it's permissionless. When I was 22, nobody would let me build fucking NVIDIA servers or whatever. Like, you know, a more robust infrastructure-led business, right? Like, if I was going to provide, I don't know, fucking routing cable services, some random shit like that. Like, maybe now, I could get into that. But e-commerce is permissionless, and that's why I like it. Agencies are permissionless. It's like, the reason why we sold on Shopify is because nobody would give us a Nordstrom's PO, right? Like, there's a level of
gatekeepers. There's a lot of things. SaaS is permissionless. Communities are permissionless. There's a lot of things that are permissionless. Newsletters are permissionless. Whatever. There's a lot of things that are permissionless. The agency one is actually more permissionless than e-com because, you know, for e-com, you have to buy inventory, right? There is a capital requirement. The agency one is different, right? That's just, I'm going to hustle my skills and I'll get cash flow. Then what you did was use that cash flow to then, you know, invest and continue to grow the brand, right? But for most people, I know a lot of people that got excited about e-com and didn't realize like how scaling works with e-com. Where
yeah, people squint and think it's SaaS and it's not. it's like your problems get harder the bigger you get, right? Like it's bigger POs, it's more management, it's everything else. Where, you know, if you're SaaS, it's like, you know, if it's 10 zeros or 1,000 zeros being processed through your thing, who the fuck cares?
Hey Sean, you've gotten more. You're a great follow on Twitter because you're hilarious. But you're this perfect combination of being hilarious, but also I think you're right, like because you've been there, done that. But has being as opinionated as you have been, and willingness to call people out, and this willingness to like say what you think, has that ever held you back? And do you regret doing that, or do you think that like going all in on being a strong personality has benefited you?
I mean, the only tangible negatives of being a public personality on the internet is if and when you get sued, because you will be sued, right? Everyone gets sued, and it's the cost of doing business. They will read your tweets in depositions. So just like that is the reality, right? I think a lot of people like don't want to like offend
you're
people.
Like that's Sean, embarrassing or yeah, what
like what did you mean by saying you want to shoot the Wobble family?
Yeah. Dude, no, like I mean I got to pose why I told someone I was going to drop a nuclear bomb on them and they read that. I had to explain, like, I don't have access to nuclear weapons. It sucked. I mean, you should be yourself and authentic. And my Twitter has sold like $300,000 worth of wallets. So definitely it's a net positive.
And your podcast, right? So your personality and being public about what you guys, how well you guys are doing with Ridge and being funny and opinionated led to you guys doing this e-com podcast, and the e-com podcast pays you a bunch of money, right? Like you guys are doing really, really well off that. So that's paid off in a different way, right? You want to talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So I only have like 4 minutes. I got to go to a call and do my real job. Maybe something you guys don't know anything about, but.
Yeah. What are you talking about?
Huh?
I take naps after this.
Yeah. So look, the reason why I got public on the internet is because in 2022, all of my friends moved across the whole world because of COVID and I didn't hang out with anybody. And it sucked for everybody. 2021, 2022, like I used to have a community of people who talk about e-commerce and then they've all moved. So I was just by myself and I'm like, let me just get on Twitter and start talking about e-commerce. And through that, I made a bunch of great friends because it's a very lonely thing running a big business. Like, you know, my best friends from high school, one of them goes to like crime scenes and cleans up like when somebody kills themselves or whatever. And the other one does garage doors. So like, imagine trying to tell them being like, yeah, man, like, you know, I spent $8 million on Meta, but I probably should have spent like, they told me to shut the fuck up. So you want to find friends who, you know, can, you know, have some sort of sympathy for what you're building. So I got on Twitter, found those people. They're all like, you know, Jason from Hexclad's on there, Mike, Beckham from Simple Modern. He has like $200 million selling fucking water bottles. Matt from Pila Case. We started a podcast. Yeah, dude.
What's it called?
It's called Operators. So it's a niche e-commerce podcast. We have spinoffs. We have marketing operators. Dude, I think it'll bill at least $2 million to sponsors, but it might bill like $4 million to sponsors. And it's just us talking about e-commerce. Probably 1/10 the listenership. I mean, way less. Maybe 1/100 the listenership you guys get. But because it's so niche, it's like way more of an actual like a community, right? And you know, I think people want to be you guys because you guys are like an entertainment show, right? You guys are like a big show, you know, massive reach, entertaining people. But if you listen to this and you're an expert at something, do an incredibly niche YouTube channel because like the sponsor integrations are just so much deeper. Like our sponsor is Fulfill the ERP, right? And like, you guys don't know what that is, but if you're an e-commerce merchant, you need an ERP and the annual contracts are $150,000 a year and we've probably sold 100 of them, right? So it's like, they'll give us $600,000 a year because we're the only marketing channel for them, right? Anyway, but yeah, so we do a podcast.
I think that's great advice. All right, we'll let you go. We know you got to go sell wallets and rings and other great things. Where should people always shout out your Twitter, shout out your URL. Where do you want people to go?
Okay, go to ridge.com/Sean and buy a wallet. That's the best way to support me right now in this Let's moment go. Of time. Never stop selling, guys.
We appreciate you, man. Thanks for doing this. All right, that's the pod. I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, less travel, never looking back. Hey everyone, a quick break. My favorite podcast guest on My First Million is Dharmesh. Dharmesh founded HubSpot. He's a billionaire. He's one of my favorite entrepreneurs on earth. And on one of our podcasts recently, he said the most valuable skill that anyone could have when it comes to making money in business is copywriting. And when I say copywriting, what I mean is writing words that get people to take action. And I agree, by the way. I learned how to be a copywriter in my 20s. It completely changed my life. I ended up starting and selling a company for tens of millions of dollars. And copywriting was the skill that made all of that happen. And the way that I learned how to copywrite is by using a technique called copywork, which is basically taking the best sales letters and I would write it word for word and I would make notes as to why each phrase was impactful and effective. And a lot of people have been asking me about copywork, so I decided to make a whole program for it. It's called Copy That. CopyThat.com. It's only like $120 and it's a simple, fast, easy way to improve your copywriting. And so if you're interested, you need to check it out. It's called Copy That. You can check it out at copythat.com.